Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Dominic Green with us. He did two articles for us last year, one called City of the Chosen, which was a wonderful piece about good old that tidy little hamlet of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then he also did another one, Taylor Swift, Nazi Barbie, that was a witty angle on a pop culture phenomenon. And what would we say? The degree of scrutiny that is out there these days. He received his PhD in history from Brandeis University. He's a critic, historian. He's now the life and arts editor of Spectator USA. He's the author of four books. He writes widely on the arts and current affairs, contributes to the Wall Street Journal, the New Criterion. I saw you in the Weekly Standard several times. And his next book, entitled The Religious Revolution, is forthcoming from Farrar Straus next year. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Dominic.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
You are one of the best, I think, European watchers from over here in the States. You've been writing about different kinds of political things going on. And I don't think we've had anyone to talk about Brexit, this steadily evolving situation over there. And so can we talk about Brexit for this half hour?
Well, I'll give it my best shot. It is steadily evolving in the way of a mudslide or other natural disaster. When the whole process began with the referendum of June 2016, some people did say it was going to turn out messy, as it has done, and others were very optimistic. But the fact is, it's turned out so messy that no one really knows what's going to happen next at all.
It's been 2 years. 2 years. Are the people who voted for Brexit getting mightily impatient?
Well, it depends who you ask and how you ask them. The whole thing is now so partisan, such division between the leavers and the remainers, that each side controls and gets the results for which it's paid for. There is a genuine feeling, I think, of wanting to get one way or the other. But as to the format it'll take, no one really knows how to get there. The fundamental problem, I think, is this, that we have pitted two kinds of democratic representation against each other. We had a direct vote, straightforward yes, no vote. Do we stay in? Do we go from the European Union? And then this direct democracy has to be processed through the representative parliamentary system.
What does processed mean, though?
Well, turned into law. Someone had then to negotiate with Brussels, with the head of the EU. But the whole thing had to be turned into domestic law and international treaties. And of course, that requires having a majority in the parliament. It was always going to be difficult in that the Conservatives, who were the ones who initially called the referendum, Conservatives have always been terribly divided over relations with the European Union. It's that caused the party to stab Mrs. Thatcher in the back in the 80s. And the division has never really gone away. And now it's come out into the open. So even the majority party was going to have trouble. And then Theresa May made the catastrophic error of calling an election in the year after the vote, in 2017. She called an election with the intention of securing a large enough majority to force through the necessary legislation. And instead, she lost her working majority, and she now leads a minority government, and she depends for support upon perhaps the most delicate of all questions, which is the relationship between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom.
Huh. Well, but going back, did her advisors, her pollsters, just get it wrong? I mean, why call an election when you're not pretty sure of the result?
I think she had a good motive, which is to do with legitimacy. She had inherited the job because the day after the Brexit referendum, David Cameron, who had called it, resigned, and he had campaigned for Britain to stay in. So he left. The Conservative Party did not put it to its members, which is how they would ordinarily elect a leader. It was fixed, as it were, inside the parliamentary party, and Theresa May emerged as the safe pair of hands, as a consensus middling candidate who could be relied upon to see things through. And of course, what happened, of course, is entirely different from that. She made all kinds of initiatives which, in fact, have turned out to be disastrous.
You mentioned that conservatives have for a long time had a divided attitude toward the EU. Is that a difference between the sort of free market conservatives and the more social or national conservatives? Is that?
I think you could call it that. It was the wets, as Mrs. Thatcher called them, the centrists who led the conservatives into the European Union in the 1970s, when the British economy was at an absolute low point, being bailed out with a low. And with the unions really strangulating the economy and also the government, there was a substantial minority of conservatives who were always against it, who were always in favor of retaining connections to the English-speaking world, to the Commonwealth, to the United States. And indeed, there were plenty of people inside the European Union as it developed who were also against it. You know, Britain only got in at the third time of asking, and twice Charles de Gaulle blocked it, quite sensibly, I would say, from his point of view, which was saying that having the British in would prevent the European Union from really forging ahead, because the British would only ever be fair weather friends. They would always have other priorities and other business to be doing. And I think de Gaulle was actually quite right about that. So the public narrowly voted to go in the 1970s. And then after that, for essentially for 40 years, nobody was particularly happy. But nobody was particularly upset. The people who were prepared to campaign on the single issue of getting out of Europe were a tiny faction in the 1990s. And it gradually grew and grew until eventually a party appeared called the UK Independence Party, whose name, as you can guess, was really because of its policy to get out at all costs, led by an entertaining scoundrel, I would call him, called Nigel Farage. And Farage and his party started to pull votes away from the right of the Conservative Party. And in 2011, the Conservatives found themselves in governing in a coalition for the first time since the early 1900s, the first peacetime coalition anyway. And so David Cameron was very concerned that the Conservatives were beginning to lose their grip as the party of, you know, the patriotic mainstream. So he called this referendum as a way of heading off this problem. And instead, of course, he miscalculated entirely and brought the whole problem center stage. So this has always gone on, yes.
What was it about UKIP that enabled them to pull people away from the Conservatives? Was it simply the idea of we're losing our sovereignty?
The idea was that you would be happy with your GDP growth and other questions, particularly, of course, questions of culture and identity, which have come to the fore across Europe and indeed also in the US. These questions were not really on the agenda at all. And gradually, of course, they did come to be some of the most important calculations in people's lives. So, and UKIP tiptoed up from being half a dozen people, you know, meeting in a room at the London School of Economics in the late 90s into a movement which could take 12% of the vote and force, you know, the most powerful party in the country to call the referendum and then to campaign and win.
And the Conservative Party simply didn't appreciate the culture issues. Just they just didn't notice because they, I mean, were they, you know, the accusation in the US of the elite, they're in the beltway. They live in another universe from the rest of us. Same thing?
Yes, there is. And there's the equivalent of the Acela Corridor too in England, which is the road from London to Oxford, or, you know, the countryside around Oxford is where David Cameron and his friends would spend their weekends. And that was pretty much their experience of the rest of Britain, really. And they badly misjudged how people felt. And I think they, because obviously wealth insulates people from the negative effects of sudden immigration. You know, they have private medicine, they use private transport, private schooling. They're not suffering from the overloading of infrastructure and welfare systems and education systems, which has happened in Europe generally because of a wave of sudden wave of immigration.
Was it you that I read a while back talking about the elite mindset, the elite sensibility that afflicted people like Cameron, and that there was this well-known moment when Cameron, is he leaving an event out in the out in the provinces somewhere? And a woman says to him, corners him and says, "What are you going to do about this immigration situation?" And he's caught on microphone saying,
"Terrible woman, dreadful woman," something like that. Yes, and this is, and what makes it perhaps even more shocking is that the politician concerned was not the Conservative saying that. It was Gordon Brown of the Labour Party. It was actually Cameron's predecessor. No, I mean, it shows how left or right this kind of attitude had sunk in, that it was retrograde, awful, provincial of people to object to sudden changes in their immediate environment, which of course is how people experience, certainly in big cities across Europe, experience immigration, and they experience it as pushing up the cost of housing, the cost of schooling, you know, the difficulties of commuting, all of these things.
Do you think that the UKIP party, Farage, is a mix of sort of honest, ordinary human concerns about home and sovereignty, and you know, the xenophobic accusations? Where would you put the mix of those things?
Well, I couldn't put a percentage to it, but I would say it's pretty well mixed. And I've attended UKIP events, and it did remind me of attending football matches in the late 70s, early 80s, which are soccer games, which were rough. You know, people went to fight at them as much as anything. On the other hand, the concerns that are being raised are also, as elsewhere in Europe, they are also being raised by more traditional and centrist right-wing parties now. I think the question of whether it was all right to even talk about patriotism, identity, these things, was a big taboo, in that it was associated for decades with the British Empire or with racism or exploitation. So what happened for a long time was that I don't think there was an acceptable form of English identity that people could publicly celebrate. And interestingly enough, it emerged spontaneously around 1996, when the European Soccer Cup was held in England. And for the first time, the Cross of St. George flag became noticeable everywhere in England as a sign of a new, you know, or a new old development in terms of how of identity. And at the time, people said, "Oh, this is, you know, this is neo-fascism. This is the old Enoch Powell racism." But that's simply not true. And again, we had, in the run-up to the Brexit referendum in 2016, a Labour politician tweeting out a photograph of a white van, you know, which is in England is the equivalent of the pickup truck, you know, the skilled worker who has, you know, risen in the world and is a traditionally minded, you know, the lower middle class, perhaps, in the US, and posting a photo of a white van with this sticker, which is a universal marker of this person in England, and saying, "Isn't this dreadful? Again, aren't these people appalling?"
Just in itself.
Yes, though, that kind of contempt for, you know, what I feel is actually a very good and decent history as well. I think there are many enormous list of things to be proud of if you happen to be born in England or grow up there. And the idea that the whole thing is shocking and disgusting and imperialism and so on is a joke, obviously, if you're a historian. But it's a joke which has been taken as the ruling ethos for decades. And indeed, if you say, dip into The Guardian or one of the other, you know, right-thinking, left-leaning newspapers, you'll still see all of that. And I think ordinary people, over a very long period, felt grossly insulted by this. You know, these are the same people that are being told that their sense of identity is shameful are the people who saw off the Kaiser and saw off Hitler. You know, this is the English, good or bad. That's who they are. And so to tell them that their past is something which is uniformly awful, must be discarded. And not only that, that it must be discarded in favor of a European identity, which is either yet to be defined or appears to be grossly bureaucratic, very undemocratic, and in fact, echoing in a sort of technocratic way, echoing the very worst of the European regimes that the English, in a way, were defined by fighting against, by all those empires and bossy Europeans who were telling us what to do. So this was really the wrong way to rub people up, I'd say.
Well, have forces in the Conservative Party looked within and said, hey, listen, we've got to soften up on this demonization of Britain, you know, British citizens from just asking about their own British Englishness, and that if we do this, we could pull them right back out of UKIP. Do you see people in the Conservative Party doing that?
Yes, there are, and I would say about a third of the Conservative MPs strongly feel much the same as the public about this, and I think that number is growing. And the fact that we've had this extension to the whole ghastly Brexit negotiation process means that in a third week of May, we have to go through the European Parliament elections, which is enormously expensive and pointless, but legally everybody is obliged to do it. And as we're still in the EU, we must do it. Now, Mr. Farage, after the referendum, walked off from his party. Looked like he told me he was going to become a TV turn instead of a politician. He spent a lot of time with Donald Trump, a lot of time in the US, but has returned to the cause, returned to the fray because of the failure of the May government to achieve Brexit of any kind. And he's formed what he has called the Brexit Party. And again, they are now set to win a bigger share of the vote in the European Parliament elections than the Conservatives or the Labour Party or any other party.
People are getting, they're ready. They're impatient.
Yes, they're ready. Yes, they are. They're absolutely ready. And one thing, and this is just anecdotal, but I travel back and forth all the time from here to there. I have noticed impatience being the common motif between people. Even people I know who are strongly in favour of remaining in the EU are impatient in the sense nobody knows where they're going to be in a year's time. You can't run a business not knowing what the terms you'll be negotiating. And the economies, of course, of Britain and the European Union countries are absolutely linked together. You know, the EU collectively is Britain's biggest trading partner. So any kind of business is in the balance.
Does the term multiculturalism apply here as a line with EU thinking, EU support?
I think it does. And what is striking is that there was a time not so long ago when the EU talked about multiculturalism, and so did the governments of its member states. And gradually, one by one, the governments in Western Europe have walked away from this. And Merkel has said it hasn't worked, multiculti, as it's called. In France, they said it hasn't worked. National identity and so on has become the gulf, really, that has opened up between the nation states of Europe. Or rather, I should say the nations of Europe. It's the peoples of Europe, more than their governments, who, you know, are on the other side of this gulf.
Has this caused a fair degree of tension between, let's just say, the intellectual purveyors of multiculturalism? I mean, the schools and the universities, a lot of the journalists and commentators, and the people. And the politicians sometimes feel sort of caught in the middle.
Yes, and I'm afraid to say that there has been an increase in violent and aggressive behavior in general towards politicians, of politicians on both sides, because of all of this in Britain. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is one of the leading voices for leaving the EU, has been mobbed as he came out of his house with his young children, you know, which is a horrible scene. His fellow Conservative, Anna Soubry, who is one of the leading voices of Remain, has also been mobbed on the steps of the Parliament by people associated with UKIP and perhaps groups further to the right of them. There's been a deterioration, I would say, in the standards of political behaviour and in the basic respect that previously would have been shown. And in part, that has risen from this demonization which has occurred. There is a slang word in England which has arisen among, you know, the left-leaning media and Remainers and so on, of calling Brexiteers, the people who want to leave, of calling them gammon.
Gammon, they're the kids in the streets?
Yeah, and they're calling them gammon, yes, because they're meant to be red-faced John Bull, you know, types and so on, which is be the equivalent of calling them white trash or something like that in the US. Is it that sort of open contempt for your fellow citizens, it's a damaging thing.
That's certainly going to work, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
That worked for that didn't work so well for Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You can't, or Mitt Romney, you know, 4 years earlier, you can't lead people whom you openly despise.
No, and it brings out their inner deplorable. If you start telling that they are deplorable, then they, you know, it puts them, it rubs them up the wrong way. It simply does. And so, you know, we have a populist moment going on in Britain, which is quite similar to the one in the US. But there's a very important difference, which I think is worth considering, which is that economically, the theme of the Trump presidency has been to do with tariffs, with protecting people from the effects of a globalized economy. The Brexit coalition really is a mixture of two completely different economic points of view. If you go to the towns of Northern England, you know, where, say, UKIP was getting votes, and I went and followed Nigel Farage up there and, you know, the local socialists threw eggs at him.
Was that caught on film?
Yes, it was, yes. That,
you know something? When these moments of humiliation and assault get put on film and then shown again and again, sent out through social media, these things don't go away now.
And it does become a normal thing in a way. You think it becomes part of the script, which isn't healthy. But if you go to those places, the people there, you know, Sheffield at one point, for instance, in the Northern England, was at one point, you know, the biggest maker of knives and forks in the world. And now I think they may not even have a single factory there. People there want to be protected from the effects of the globalized economy, very much like in the US, say. On the other hand, a lot of the middle class and a lot of the political, you know, supporters in politics, Brexit, a lot of those people want the opposite. They want access to global markets. They want Britain to be, you know, a sort of buccaneering global trade power, roving across the oceans and cutting deals with the Chinese and the Indians and the Brazilians and, of course, the US. And that's a completely different, that's the opposite thing. They're saying we don't want less globalization. They're saying we want maximum globalization. We want to get out of the EU's tariffs and limitations and so on.
Okay, how is this going to play out?
Right. Well, we're all hoping now for the Deus Ex Machina. We're hoping for someone to throw down a lightning bolt from Brussels and fix it for us. It may be that, say, Emmanuel Macron of France, who is himself pushing now for the EU to finally become a single state with a central fiscal policy, like the Fed in the US, capable of redistributing debt, in other words, between the member states. Macron is pushing hard for the final stages of creating a United States of Europe. And like de Gaulle before him, he knows that having the British inside is going to be a drag.
So he wants them out.
Well, exactly. And he has said that we are not committed to sort of open-ended extensions and bumbling onwards with Britain halfway in, halfway out, and making trouble. It's quite possible that given the disorganization in the Conservative Party and in Britain generally, it's quite possible that the release from this whole situation will come from outside, with the European Union pushed by Macron saying, we've had it, go your own way, and so on. I think one thing is this, it took 40 years to get into this. It's going to take 10 or 20 years to dig our way out of it. We have to make a completely new set of laws concerning every single thing that crosses these borders. So all that counts for now, I think, is to set Britain on a diverging path from the EU. Doesn't have to be massive, just has to be enough to set 27 states going one way and one state going the other. And then I think gravity will play out and there'll be a slow divergence, which will sort of be fitted together as it goes on. The idea of coming up with a single treaty now that we can all sign and then it's done, it's not going to be like, say, the Treaty of Paris, you know, after the American Revolution. It's going to be a series of small fixes.
Where, if that happens, if you get, what would you call that kind of, would you call that Brexit? That would be the fulfillment. That wouldn't be the soft. That would be a real Brexit.
Yeah, I think it's going to start as a soft Brexit and then by degrees become a permanent arrangement. And it's possible to stay within the customs union of Europe, as, say, Norway does, without subscribing to all the other laws. There'll be some kind of combination of these things.
So a skillful conservative politician will say, we got this, but we resisted that, which is exactly what you wanted us to resist. But without losing, you think they can finesse that with the Brexiteer?
Well, yes, you would. I mean, the thing is, Theresa May came up with a deal with Brussels, which she said was, I'm giving you the thing you wanted, because she had got a commitment from the European Union that Britain would not be obliged to take in any immigrants from Europe. Because for her understanding, in that elite understanding, the problem with Brexit was all about immigration. It wasn't a matter of sovereignty or democracy or accountability or even coherence. It was just immigration. So she figured that if she threw the masses a little bone on immigration, all the economic arrangements and legal arrangements could stay the same way. But it turns out that no one liked that deal because it is not just about immigration. It's also about law and sovereignty and democracy and accountability. So if we have a starter deal now that, you know, gets us through this stage, eventually it's going to turn into something else, because I don't believe that, having come this far, that people in Britain are going to say, yeah, this is fine. They're going to want the whole thing. They're going to want control over their own laws and to be governed by people they elect.
If your version of Brexit goes through, and over time, will that satisfy the political discontent of many of the Brexiteers?
That, again, is a good question. Partly it depends what kind of economic arrangements we end up with, because there's two factions in the Brexiteers there, and only one of them is going to be happy with it. What will happen, though, I believe, is that as long as something is done, a lot of the steam will be taken out of the whole issue, where recent polls have shown that Britain is much more receptive towards immigrants and much more tolerant towards immigrants and their children than any other European country. And the degree of tolerance has risen in recent polls, and it's probably because people felt that at last they were being listened to because of the Brexit referendum. So I could see a situation where people wouldn't necessarily be delighted with what happened, but they wouldn't be so upset about it that they would consider voting for a single issue party like the Brexit Party or UKIP.
Well, sometimes I think that the people, the masses, they don't want one. They don't need 100% compliance from their representatives. They just want to hear the representatives take what they say seriously and meet them to some degree. You know, when you talk about the contempt factor, the condescension factor, in a way you start thinking this is not so much about results as just starting to at least pretend, give a little bit of show to the fact that these people have some legitimate concerns, and let's not smear them right off the bat.
I think that's very true. And again, I don't know if you think they're legitimate or they should be treated with the same amount of respect. But before UKIP became a major force, there was actually a breakaway party of the left, which was a sort of startup between hard leftists and Islamist parties. And they actually called their party Respect. In other words, that they were not being listened to or treated as deserving of taking part in the politics. And again, it's a matter of opinion whether they should be respected.
What happened to them?
Well, they lost their appeal because the Labour Party tracked onto that terrain. Under Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party has turned sharply left. So now, if you were thinking of voting for Respect, you don't need to do that. You could actually vote for a party that has a possibility of becoming the party of government.
Is there any expectation that the Labour Party is going to triumph?
It's possible, simply because the Conservatives have been in since 2011, which will mean by the next election, they'll have been there for a decade. And Labour is consistently polling neck and neck. There is also a party in Scotland, the Scottish Nationalists, who are also a left-wing statist party. and Labour could easily form an alliance with them and also with the Liberal Democrats, who are closer to Labour than Conservatives. So it's very possible that they could cobble together a coalition and with Jeremy Corbyn as its leader. And of course that, well, there's two things you could say about that regarding Brexit. One is it would cause the biggest capital flight in British history, because every foreign company, and there are more trades, remember, more trades in the London Stock Exchange in a day than there are in New York. All of that money will vanish. And the other thing that will happen is you'll probably get a much harder Brexit than you would under the Conservatives, because Jeremy Corbyn, being a lifelong anti-capitalist, has always detested the European Union because he's seen it as a neoliberal project, which, of course, in many ways it was. The last thing someone like him wants is the free movement of goods and services and labour. So ironically, if he did come in, you'd also end up with a serious and probably quite rapid breach with the European Union. And that isn't in the interests of Britain or indeed of the European Union or indeed of the United States.
So Conservatives will have to unite or draw UKIP, enough of UKIP back in.
Yeah, there is, of course, the other scenario, which is that they actually have to form a coalition of their own and acknowledge, you know, this, that they've bungled it, as it were. They've not catered to people, not just the right of the party, but the grassroots of the party. The Conservative Party's membership, which is shrinking and which is old, but nevertheless, Conservative Party membership are strongly, much more like UKIP than they are like the centrists in the parliament. So they're still not in sync with their natural voters.
Last question: where is the youth vote? The 20-year-olds on this in England.
Well, the 20-year-olds are, as in the US, they're mostly in college, and therefore of a frame of mind to vote for anything which is free. And are strongly in favour of Jeremy Corbyn and Labour, who are promising free tuition and free everything. Corbyn keeps soft peddling the question of his opinion on Brexit because a lot of young people are against it. But they will change. I mean, that's what happens as people get older. They start listening to opera and they start changing their votes. So this process...
I like that.
This process, you know, it's going to take years. And today's youth are going to be tomorrow's mortgage owners. And how they think
parents.
About... Yes, exactly. That suddenly their perspectives will change as well.
Okay. All right. Dominic Green, thank you for joining us. We will have you back in 4 or 5 months to weigh in again. Tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mark.